first of all, I just want to thank you, Tom, for taking time to be on the call here. And that's actually Tom Mahon, the way Tom says it. And before I start introducing him, I just want to give a little background, which I've shared with Tom on a couple occasions, but I feel like my heart sings that introduction every time because I'm just so grateful for it. Back when, you know, we were, before Service Space was Service Space, it was called Charity Focus. In April 99, four of us were starting this organization just to try to bring humanity into the Silicon Valley, which is where we were planted. And, you know, Tom looks at four of us and he said, wow, this is a great thing. He really encouraged us. He ended up talking about it in one of his press interviews. And the guy interviewing him ended up doing a story that was the first story in Christian Science Monitor around Charity Focus and what we were doing. And that person who wrote the story ended up, many years later, he actually ended up becoming the editor, the editor of Christian Science Monitor. And he retired, he came back, and he not only to volunteer with us, but now he's working on a book on Service Space. So really awesome, Tom, to have you on the call. From that, you know, when we were four people, you encouraged us, and, you know, we're a 400,000 member ecosystem now, and you're still encouraging us. So thanks for being here on the call.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me, Nipun.
Yeah.
And the feeling is mutual, too. I mean, what you've done from four people, even if it had only stayed four people, was still a very worthwhile endeavor, and it still unfortunately runs against the mainstream current in the Valley, but the evidence of 400,000 people affiliated with Service Space now indicates the crying need for what it is you and the others are doing and talking about and actually putting into practice.
Oh, thank you. It means a lot. Tom, to give people a little bit more context of Tom, Tom has had a very colorful life. He has been a merchant sailor, a pipe fitter, a filmmaker, a novelist, a glass artisan in more recent years. But for 40 years, he was a public relations consultant for technology companies, mostly in the Silicon Valley. His writing's been published all over the place. I mean, from the Wall Street Journal to the, you know, the Double E Times, which is a technical journal, and his work's been covered in, you know, CNN and New York Times, to name a few. He's written several books. Most recently, I don't know if this is out. We'll ask Tom about it a little later on, but it's called reconnecting.com. That's not .com, that's C-A-L-M. and the subtitle is Finding Common Ground for Science, Technology, and Faith. So Tom has done a lot, but I remember the first time when I saw Tom in a public gathering, I think he was doing a one-man play called Are We Having Fun Yet? And he just, like, he speaks so directly about the values that make us human, that people just light up. And, you know, I think the essence of his message has always been to highlight sort of the need to reconnect technical capability with social responsibility, or as he would say, to reintegrate tech knowledge with self knowledge. So here he was talking to all kinds of, you know, engineers and technologists and saying, hey man, you know, doctors take the Hippocratic Oath, what about engineers? You know, and these were questions, particularly in the 90s, that really no one was asking. So Tom has always been 20 years ahead of his time, I would say, maybe more. So that's Tom Mahon. Really happy to have him on the call. Our format, I'll see if you, we'll engage in some dialogues, and then we'll open it up for Q&A in about half an hour. And I wanted to start with a question, which we have actually a quote from your most recent book, and that dovetails into a question around technology. And the quote reads, carpenters, surgeons, architects, bakers, software engineers, and mystics all seek to impose mind on matter. When the mind is calm and focused, the results can be elegant. The bicycle, the Mustang, cathedral, the ode to joy. But when the mind is anxious or wobbly, or our heart is two sizes too small, the results can be disastrous. Crash-prone software, nutrition-less food, bridges that collapse, weapons of mass destruction. And so, Tom, I want to start with, you know, that dichotomy and have you talk a little bit about, you know, what it means to reconnect, you know, technical capability with social responsibility, but really like bridging that connection of wisdom traditions and technical engineering, so to speak. And what do you think is the goal? Like, how should we even frame the goal of technology? Is it technology just for its own sake, or do we, you know, how can we pause and maybe ask some deeper questions of, you know, it's not just that we want to go out and do stuff. Like, why do we want to do that? You know, so I'd love for you to open with a few comments on that.
Sure. Thank you, Nipun. I think that given the circumstances that the world is in right now, we need to stop and rethink the whole purpose of technology. In the ancient world, people understood that science was the way we could discover truth. And technology was the way that we could make beautiful things and do good actions. And in the classical world, 2,500 years ago, the pursuit of beauty, truth, and goodness was seen to be the mark of a wise life. And science and technology were the means to those ends, but just the means. They weren't the ends themselves. What we've done now is to make science and technology the ends of themselves. And if you could imagine a high-tech CEO or an academic or anybody in an influential position saying that they were doing their work in the pursuit of beauty, truth, and goodness, they'd probably very soon be in pursuit of a new job. We leave these issues completely separate. And in fact, we've replaced or we've changed our thinking of science and technology away from being means to noble ends to being the ends in themselves. And very often those ends are taken over by people whose time horizon is no further than the next investor call in 12 weeks. So I think we need to really stop and rethink the whole nature of science and technology again. The headline in this morning's Wall Street Journal is that our Defense Department is bulking up for impending war with Iran. It just, you know, even if we were living on another planet and not involved in this, it would bring tears to your eyes to think that all this high-tech stuff is yet again being focused on belligerent issues instead of attending to some of the very real, more pressing human issues. And if I could, I'd like to step back to how I got into this. And that was when I first started writing about technology 40 years ago, I'd spent the first 30 years of my life in a world where faith and the humanities and the fine arts were very important and very, very well, widely accepted as what composes a civil life. But by accident, I began getting work writing about computers for the local computer companies in Minneapolis then, and there were quite a few. Univac, Control Data, Honeywell. And because I wanted to do a good job on behalf of my clients, I started asking people, what's an electron? If I'm writing about electronics, it would be good to know what an electron is. And so many people were very kind and gave me their time and gave me answers. The only trouble is that none of the answers corresponded to the other answers, which I guess is probably what's meant by the uncertainty principle. You can't give a full definition of an electron. But like a pesky kid, I kept asking people to explain it to me, and finally the engineers just sort of threw up their hands and said, you've left our domain. You're really now asking questions that belong to physicists. So why don't you go talk to physicists, which was probably a nice way of getting me off their hands. So I went and talked to a bunch of physicists, you know, what is an electron? And no matter what answer they gave, I said, well, tell me more. Give me a further example, et cetera. And finally, they said, you've left the realm of physics. You really need to talk to theologians at this point. And this was in the early 1980s, and there were not many theologians who had a clue what an electron was. But I had the good fortune to find one, a man named Andy Duffner, a Jesuit doing postdoctoral work in particle physics at Lawrence Berkeley back in 83. And we had dinner together one night, and it happened that from the Berkeley, the Jesuit house in Berkeley, you could look out the window straight ahead across the bay to the Golden Gate Bridge, and the sun was setting. And it was like one of those aha moments where you have a feeling you're not in Kansas anymore. I mean, he took my question seriously about where does science and technology intersect with theology. And it was like, my God, I'm not the only person in the world. I'm not crazy. I'm not the only person in the world asking these questions. And I watched over the years as the issue of science and technology has almost grown to be a cottage industry. Back then, there was probably only one book on the subject. Today, if you go in Barnes & Noble, there's this whole rows of books on this issue. But over the years, I noticed nobody's writing about technology and faith. Science is an academic discipline. Theology is an academic discipline. They both deal in first principles. But nobody's talking about where these things impact daily life. And that's technology, which is the application of scientific principles, and faith, which is where your belief system meets the day-to-day. And there are many religions in the world, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, but they all agree that there's really only one faith, and that's in acts of loving kindness, or ahimsa, or corporal works of mercy. So I became curious. I don't have the credentials, the academic credentials, to talk about science or theology, but I was living in the world of technology and religion. I worked in the high-tech world. Some of my clients or my employers were household names. Then I have to go home and talk to my kids, and, you know, how do you span that gap? And it really came home to me one day as we were leaving Mass one morning. One of my sons said to me, Dad, which universe do we live in? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, is it the flat one in church or the round one on TV? And what he meant by the flat one is the Nicene Creed, the core belief statement of Christianity, shows the world as a flat surface with the dome of heaven above and the bowl of heaven of hell down below. And that really got me thinking, this has got some real here and now impact. How do we take these theories and express them in a world where kids don't see angels with feathered wings, and mall rats wouldn't know a shepherd if one came up and bit them in the ankle? And it seemed that there was some need to kind of bring the wisdom of the past, express it in the language that people would know today. So that's what sort of set me off on the charter for the second half of my life, since the early 1970s. And I came to think that there were four things that we could do as lay people. And because I'm in marketing, I call them the four P's. To pause from the tsunami of information that we get every day, and to take a data Sabbath, whether that's a certain time every day or literally take the seventh day of the week and unplug ourselves. And then in that pausing, to appreciate the interconnects all around us. One day I was sitting looking out the window, and I watched a gentle wind blowing through the grass, and I realized this is the residue of the Big Bang. The grass is energy that became matter, and the wind is still the energy floating through the sky. And the interaction of wind on grass is the signature, it's a fingerprint of the Big Bang, and it's all connected. John Muir, the great naturalist who invented the National Park Service, once said that I find if I touch anything in the world, it's connected to everything in the universe. And in pausing, that's a good thing. That's an appropriate thing to think about. Take any two of the most dichotomous things you could imagine and stop and think about it, and they're connected, probably within only a few degrees of separation. And then I think that we need to rediscover the two golden nuggets of antiquity to guide us through this silicon civilization. One is to pray or meditate to achieve a state of composure, and in that way to put into practice the golden mean, the middle way between a life of too much and not enough. And these are not new issues. 2,500 years ago, the ancient Greeks found that a way to deal with this was the story of the Icarus and his father. The father informed the son, if you're going to, here are some waxen wings to fly out of a predicament. But don't fly so high that the sun melts the wings or so low the waves grab you. And Icarus didn't take that advice. He didn't pursue the middle path. And so the sun melted his wings and he fell in the sea. So we need to remind ourselves to rethink about what does the middle way mean in the life that we're living now. And, of course, the greatest story to that is the one that we all learned as children, the story of Goldilocks, who took the golden mean. She didn't want soup that was too hot or too cold, but just right. And finally, the fourth P I put is to participate in the golden rule. There's a silver rule that says, do not do unto others what you would find abhorrent if done to you. But the golden rule turns that on its head, and it's more emphatic. It's do to others what you would like them to do to you. And so I think that that antiquity has left us with two golden nuggets to help us in this Silicon society, to rekindle the golden mean, a life of moderation, and the golden rule, to do unto others exactly as we'd like done to you. And I've invited some friends of mine to be on the phone. And if they're not familiar with Service Space, I encourage them to check. I've given them the website, and I encourage them to check it again, because what Service Space is doing is enkindling both of those, the golden mean and the golden rule. And kudos to you, Nipun, and to all the hundreds of thousands of people who in one way or another are connected. They are, in fact, living these two golden nuggets. And the question then is, how do we propagate this even further so that people at the Pentagon think that there may be other ways to deal with this issue?
Yeah.
To launch into shock and awe.
Yeah. No.
So that's my shtick, and I've put all this together in an ebook that I call reconnecting.com, CALM. It's on sale now at Amazon, Barnes and Noble, and Google Books. And you can look it up there by the title or by my name. And I also have a website that goes into a lot of depth goes into much of what is in the book at reconnectingcom.com. That is www.reconnectingcalm.com. So that's the story, and I'm sticking to it.
Tom, I wanted to probe one further. First of all, your idea of data Sabbath, I remember hearing that back in the days. And you know, in the 90s, it was like, yeah, maybe, you know, and now you look at it and there's this massive ADD, there's this massive information overload. Everyone's feeling stressed out by just having too much data. You know, it was definitely ahead of its time. It's very, very relevant now, this idea of taking a data Sabbath, even a technology Sabbath, you know. But what it kind of points me towards is, you know, the future direction and where you think we're headed. I remember this great big debate that happened in the early 2000s between Bill Joy and Ray Kurzweil, where Ray Kurzweil wrote this book called Age of Spiritual Machines, essentially saying we're headed towards machines, there's no way to stop it, and, you know, they're going to come together. And Bill Joy, sort of, you know, the chief scientist at Sun Microsystems at the time where I was working earlier, and he was raising the humane question, saying, "Hey, the future doesn't need us." That was the title of his article in Wired magazine, saying that we just might outsource ourselves. And so I was wondering if you could, Tom, pontificate a little bit about like where you think the future, because you've always been in a way a futurist. You're able to see patterns before they emerge, and so I wonder what if you could shed some light on what you are seeing now, and what you think we can do perhaps to kind of perhaps nudge it in this direction of in the Bill Joy direction, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, I'm Irish on both sides all the way back, and sometimes some of us Irish have a dark side, and we tend to see the glass as half empty. And until last summer, I was definitely in that category. But the analogy I make, and I hope this doesn't seem like I'm stretching too far, but 65 million years ago, an asteroid hit the Earth, and it sent up a dust cloud. And within a year and a half, the dinosaurs were finished. I mean, it seems incredible that after a billion years or whatever, the dinosaurs would go extinct in less than 2 years. But it wasn't the end of anything. Scurrying around their feet and trying to avoid being stepped on by them were little tiny shrews and mice and other small mammals. And in only 65 million years, those mammals generated us. In other words, dinosaurs are dying all around us right now, metaphorically. And what we have to do is just stay alive and keep on keeping on until they clear the field. And it's probably, you know, I try not to think of it too much, but it's probably going to be a painful transition. Well, we see it already in the crash that started in 08. But we also see something happening underfoot, and that is the Arab Spring, for instance, the Occupy movement, and so many other things that are saying, you know, you big institutions are going to go away. You know that. But we're still going to be here and making our life. And I deal with that every morning when I'm on so many lists that I open up my email and I'm just inundated with bad news, such that I got to stop reading it. But always in the middle there, the only one that I read every day is Daily Good. It reminds me, oh yeah, the sun came up this morning, we're still here. What I say in the book is, in a sense, Gandhi had it easy. If you'll pardon that. He didn't, of course, but there was an identifiable group that he wanted to leave India. They were self-identified because they wore red coats and they marched around with rifles. We have malignant cells in our own national body, our own cultural body. How do we treat that? How do we get rid of this cancer that is within our society and do it with loving kindness? I mean, that to me is probably the biggest issue of our time. It does no good to sit on street corners and bang pots and pans. I mean, it's a way to vent, but that's not going to do it. And just retreating off to a hermitage and doing breathing exercises isn't going to do it. I think the biggest thing confronting us is, how do we redeem our own society, realizing that all of us have some foot in the 1%, whether we're there or whether we aspire to it. How do we transform a civilization that is clearly in decline? We built our whole society on infinite consumption of finite resources. If you do the math, that doesn't work, and we're seeing that all around us. And we see a political campaign going on by candidates who say, which promising that I'll be the one who violates global warming the most, or I'll be the one who gets us into even more wars, or I'll be the one who promotes income inequality. It's enough to make you pull your hair out, but you can't stop there. You've got to say, okay, where do we go from here? How do we save and build on the very best in our society? And that's what I try to address in this book.
You alluded to the, you know, you said you were glass half empty up until last summer. And I don't know if everyone has read your remarkable blog post that you had posted up, but I was wondering if you could retell your experience in brief around, you know, what that experience was like being unconscious for 6 weeks in the hospital last summer and how that has changed you.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, it was a life-changing experience, of course. I went in for surgery on July 1st for something on my cervical spine, the neck spine, and expected to be back home in 3 or 4 days, and woke up 6 weeks later, and my wife's beautiful face was in front of me, and she said, "Tom, do you know who I am?" And I rolled my eyes like, "Well, we've been married 38 years, Mary. Yeah, I know who you are." And she turned to the person next to her and said, "Well, he's back," and just as sarcastic as ever. And I thought it was July 3rd, and she told me it was August 21st, and that was a shock. And when you come to out of something like that, well, what happened was all of my systems cascaded and went shut down. I had a mini stroke, atrial fibrillation. My lungs stopped working, and I had to be intubated for a month. My kidney, liver, and pancreas all shut down. And my surgeon later told me that I was very, very close to passing over on several occasions. And, of course, I was unaware of all this. So I woke up thinking 2 days had passed. And apparently there's medications they can give you so that you're amnesiac. You don't remember any of it. You don't remember any dreams you had. And when I came to, I was in a state of shock because I couldn't move my limbs at all. I was paralyzed. The only thing I could do was move my head from left to right in the intensive care unit, and I saw bodies on both sides of me, all of them in agony. And instead of being panicked at my own paralysis, it was just like an amazing thing. I felt this sea of light washing over all of us broken ones. And instead of being repulsed by the broken shapes all around me and realizing that I was one of them, I had this incredible sense of compassion, which in its original meaning meant to suffer with. And that's exactly what we were doing together. And I felt an incredible bond between all of us, strangers to me, to the healthcare providers who were so, so good at what they were doing. And then by extension, I, against my better judgment, I felt this sense of warmth even to Dick Cheney. And it just, like, what are you saying, Tom? You know, keep that anger going. No, it doesn't seem right anymore. And I came to realize, you know, if you want to see the face of God, if you can't find it in the face of a stranger, there's probably something wrong with the way you're searching. And then, again, against my better judgment, I said, no, it's even more than that. We have to look for the face of God in our enemy. And man, was that a hard thing for me to swallow. But I realized that that's what all the old-timers were saying. And man, that's an epiphany. When you realize that it's not us against them anymore. In fact, to test it out, I watched Dick Cheney on an interview after I came to, and I didn't feel, my head didn't explode. I didn't feel anger towards the man. I just felt, there is a very broken man, like me. And that's... I hope it doesn't take a near-death experience to have that passage, but that's what it took for me, and it stayed with me. Not with the intensity of last summer, but it stayed with me. And I guess what it is if you really want to look at the face of God, try to find it in the face of your enemy. If we can't do that, we've still got a lot of work to do, individually and as a society.
That's beautiful. Thank you. So if you have a question, Tom, I've got one more question for you. I've probably got plenty more questions for you, but we are going to open up the line. So if you have a question for Tom or a comment or just want to say something, hit *6 and then you'll be queued up. We have another... roughly about 30 minutes. We do try to end on time. So if you have a question or a comment, press *6. Tom, while the queue is warming up, I wanted to probe a little further. And this is, in a way, going away from our technology question, which is equally relevant. But, you know, what was it for you that pushed you in this direction? Because you're clearly coming from a very deep sacred space of authentic personal experience. I mean, that you have done some kind of spiritual work, and I've never heard you talk about your own sort of inner work and how you approach your inner landscape, and or if you do at all, or if it's just a natural thing that happens when it's supposed to happen. But I wondered if you could share a little bit about what spirituality has meant to you and how you have more formally, like, tried to, you know, deepen your awareness and practice.
Well, I was raised Irish Catholic in a community that was almost entirely Irish Catholic, St. Paul, Minnesota. And unlike our Irish mates in New York and Boston, there was no Anglo aristocracy sitting on top of us. We had the run of the place, which is why Governor Ventura, when he was governor of Minnesota, said that the crazy street pattern was laid out by drunken Irishmen, to which we responded, "What's your issue?" And it's a very, the way I was brought up, or the way I took it, it was an incredibly suffocating worldview, such that by the time I was 20, I just crashed and burned. I hit the wall and had to drop out of school. I was told this was the way things had to be, and constantly the threat of eternal hell is in front of you. And it's a very suffocating. I'm glad to see that Irish Catholicism is sort of going away to be replaced by Celtic spirituality, the Christianity that St. Patrick taught, which is much more humane and nature-based. Anyway, I was in a really tough place at the age of 20 in 1964. And fortunately, I had an uncle who'd been a merchant mariner for 30 years. He'd been in the U.S. Merchant Marine. And he said, "If you ever want to, I could arrange for you to, in effect, run away to sea." And I did. And living out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean is just an incredible experience. I had been raised with such a suffocating sense of God as the eternal judge, ready to wait for you to make one mistake and screw you in the ground. And out there, I was literally taken back to the first lines of the book of Genesis, where there was the water below and the water above, and the spirit hovered in the middle. And if you watch a sunset out in the middle of the ocean, in the space of 70 million square miles of open sea, it just blows all the cobwebs out of your head. And one morning in late September 67, I was on a ship steaming up from L.A. to San Francisco, and my duties required me to turn to at daybreak, and I stepped out on deck just the minute the sun broke over the Santa Lucia Mountains in Big Sur. And I'm not sure, but I think I may have fallen to my knees, because it was like Paul falling off his donkey on the road to Damascus. It was like, for only a matter of a few seconds, everything fell into place, just like it did last summer. For a matter of a few seconds, it was like, now I get it. There's nothing to worry about. It's all okay. And I've tried since then, whenever I'm down, to recap those brief moments, because that to me was like, okay, you have to step outside the box and almost start all over again as a catechumen. And that's what I've been doing for the past, I guess, almost 50 years now. I don't belong to any form of religion, because once burned, I'm not going to step into some other dogmatic box. But I don't pray anymore. I've tried to meditate for 50 years, and I can never sit still long enough to do it. I'm going on, but one last thing. I was in an interview with Karen Armstrong when her first book about God came out. And I asked her in the Q&A after the book signing, how does she practice religion? She's raised a Catholic. She's taught at a school for rabbis, and now she's teaching at a school for imams. And I said, with all these traditions, how do you pray? And she said, somebody told me that every time you make a connection, that's a prayer. And she said, I've been doing a lot of praying lately. And that, to me, I think is how I pray. I see things that on the surface are so diametrically opposite, but in fact, if you give them just a moment's thought, you'll see that they're all connected
Wow.
inextricably. It's like the universe is a hologram. Each part contains the whole, and the whole is found in each part.
That's beautiful. Thank you. We have a bunch of questions queued up. Again, if you do want to get in on the queue, you want to hit star six. And then whenever your turn is up, you will hear a little message that says you're up. So we'll start with the first question.
Thank you, Nipun. Thank you, Tom, so much. This is Prakash. We have not met you yet. With this talk and through your blog and your work, you really welcomed us into your heart space. Thank you. And we wish you continued best of health, and so that you continue to spread the .calm to all the .comers and beyond. My question, more of a request, is, and we have not met you, but we want you to know that we all love you. The request is for specifically for your health, and our wish that you continue to stay in this body. How can we help? Thank you.
Well, first of all, I'm overwhelmed with your gracious words. Thank you very much for saying that. How can you help? I mean, I guess, unlike Nipun, I'm not an organizer. I'm not trying to start a new religion or even start any kind of a formal thing. I just, what I'm trying to do is put some ideas out there that you can interpret into your own life, and how can you best do it. And if you go to the website, reconnectingcom.com, C-O-M, there's a page on best practices. And I would hope that that might inspire some things to do. It points to some organizations like Service Space and like others that are in need of volunteers because they embody what I'm talking about. And I would hope that as people come to this site and know of other best practices, they'll let me know about them so that I can put them there as well. I'll leave it at that. I have some groups and organizations at best practices at my website that I would point you to. And if you know of others, please let me know, and I'll add them there. Basically, I guess if I could sum it up, in 1965, Pope Paul VI came to the UN, and he said words that have long outlived him. He said, if you want peace, work for justice. And how do we work? With tools. And tools are just a simple Anglo-Saxon word for technology. So what we have to do is, how do we reconfigure our tools or redirect our tools to work for justice and thereby work for peace?
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go to the next question. Again, if you hit *6 if you want to get in on the queue of questions.
Am I on?
Yes, you're on now, yes.
Shiv Talwar from Waterloo, Ontario again. I'm so happy that I heard Tom speak. Although Tom and I have been talking on the phone briefly for over a year in our attempt to get Tom to Waterloo. It was nice to hear him personally talking about his experiences and about his thoughts. Tom, we at Spiritual Heritage Education Network, we've been considering the question of human condition. Most of us come from India, and we lived in the north, and we saw in 1947 almost a million people were killed in the partition, and that experience was a terrifying experience. I was pretty young at that time. And since that time, we've been
I think we might have lost him. We will wait till he comes back. We'll go to the next caller.
Oh, hi, this is Bill Miller. I was struck by your comment that you had this epiphany after your 6 weeks of unconsciousness, and you're hoping it didn't require a near-death experience for people to have that similar change of heart. And I'm wondering if you could just say any more, kind of verbalize what changed in your mind, because I know I certainly too struggle with not hating people who seem to be having such a negative, malicious effect on society. So what was it that enabled you to, or how would you state it, that enabled you to shift?
Bill, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, I am nowhere near mastering it. I just, fortunately, my wife is constantly reminds me to walk the talk. I mean, it's easy to talk about these things. It's another to live them. But my wife keeps me honest and lets me know when I'm getting back in the old rut, for which I'm eternally grateful. She's upstairs. She can't hear me. Although I've told her this, so it's not like something I'm trying to keep from. It's good to have somebody who can keep you on the straight and narrow, but failing that, I guess just, you know, pulling back even for a few minutes every day to think, okay, this is where I should be. Where am I, and how do I get to that point? Because there's no, you know, I've gone back to having real concern about, I'm struggling with, should I get back involved in the campaign this year as I was in 08, or should I just not let myself get that upset? I don't know the answer. I just know that the best thing to do is probably at least take a few minutes every day to say, this is where I want to be. Did I get any closer today? Or if I didn't, how can I? And, you know, St. Paul, when he fell off his donkey, may have had an immediate change of heart that stayed his whole life. To me, it's something of an issue every day I have to deal with. By the way,
thank you.
Thank you, Bill. If I was going to ask Shiv to let you know his website, if you want to know more about his work, it's at www.spiritualeducation.org, and that will tell you more about what he and his group are doing that isn't just this one conference, but ongoing work.
Before we go on to the next question, and again, star six, if you want to jump in on the queue, Tom, I wanted to, in a way, this is a common theme and question that a couple of people have alluded to, and I think everybody wants to address in their own ways, a big challenge of technology. How do you have people reframe technology with some of these questions in mind? And you in your book, you talk about, and you have talked about this before as well, we understand how hammers work, but microprocessors are far more complex and different, you know. And so there's this sense of, like, there's this black box technology promise, you know, that, oh, just trust the black box, it all works inside. But we don't know the organizing principles inside. And so you speak about this idea of technology literacy, which is really about, you know, getting acquainted with some of the design principles. Can you speak a little bit about that before we go on to the next question?
Yeah. My book is divided in three parts: technology, science, and faith, and then tying them together, which is what the subtitle promises, finding common ground for these three. The first third of the book is a primer on technology. You know, I find it amazing. We live in a technocentric world, but nobody teaches technology. I mean, of course, there's programs in engineering, but we teach eight-year-olds in third grade what the basics of science, what a cell is, you know, what the solar system is. We don't teach anything about technology. And in a broad brush, technology has gone through three or four phases. The first tools we had leveraged our muscles, and that made sense because we had to build residences, we had to drain swamps, we had to clear forests. So we invented tools based on the wedge, the axe, the scalpel, the spear. And then the second wave of technology started 400 years ago with the scientific revolution, tools that leverage our senses, leading up to the radio and the television, to sight and sound, microscope, telescope, all these other great things. The third wave of technology started in our own lifetime, or close enough, and that was leveraging our brains, the microprocessor, radio communications, the internet, it seems to me the next step is to leverage our spirits. And how we're going to do that is going to take a collaborative effort. At best, all I can do is outline some things. It's something I have to deal with every day in my own life, but at least raise the question. We have this incredible portfolio of tools at our disposal now. Are we going to let ourselves become the tool of our tools? Are we going to pride ourselves in our ignorance of how these tools work? We think them from the ground up and say, every time you use a tool, not just an electronic device, but a car, a hammer, whatever, am I using this to manifest grace? Or is what I'm doing being destructive to me or to somebody else at the other end? And by destructive, I mean things like flaming somebody on an email. You know, am I using this tool, whatever it is, as basic as a hammer or as sophisticated as a microprocessor? Does this manifest grace or ahimsa, or does it not do anything, which is probably okay? Or is it being harmful to me or someone else? And then to act accordingly. Basically, it's being conscious of the science at our disposal.
Mm. Oh, that's great. Thank you. Rahul?
Yes, thanks, Boone. So in the service-based ecosystem, we often talk about technology as being an amplifier of will and intent, and that sort of makes it sound like it's a values-neutral thing. So kind of dovetailing on the last response you gave, I was wondering if you feel like technology is values-neutral, or if the sort of underlying cultural values that a technology springs up from are just this inevitable persistent force built into the technology that we're not able to escape from, if that makes sense. In the sense
yeah,
that...
Yeah, it does.
Okay, go ahead.
There are some tools that are dual use, you know, like a hammer. You can use it to build a house or knock somebody on the head. There's some tools that are clearly beneficial. Prayer is a tool. If we think about it, tools literally are anything of human design. So that would include prayer, meditation, singing, chanting. And then there's some tools that are clearly of no good use, weapons of mass destruction. The thing is that as a society, we pretty much let people take over tools who are driven by the profit motive, who have put property rights over human rights. And we've been remiss in, by our not knowing much about tools themselves, by not being technology literate, we've sort of let others drive the agenda of what tools are for. Social media is a wonderful thing, but it's been so commercialized that it's almost ludicrous. I mean that a company could have a 5-year-old company could have a market valuation of $100 billion is only because they have $300 billion worth of information on you and me. Is that a good thing? Maybe not. And we have sort of defaulted and let for-profit businesses take over technology. And that doesn't have to be that way. And maybe if I have one message, that's it. You know, it doesn't have to be the way it is. We can take it back and redesign it for human ends. At least starting in our own life. And eventually you get a critical mass and things change for the better. But it takes the involvement of a whole lot of people to create that critical mass. We need to reclaim a human handle on our tools. One referred to Ray Kurzweil and in his book, Age of Spiritual Machines. And since then, Kurzweil has been talking about, by the middle of the 21st century, the singularity at which we will become so dependent on tools that we will, in effect, cease to exist as carbon-based life forms and morph into silicon-based intelligence machines. And some of the wealthiest people in the Valley are buying onto this, including the two founders at Google, such that, Kurzweil himself takes, according to the New York Times, 150 pills a day to prolong his life until the singularity becomes real. Well, I mean, my God, what a perversion, to extend your life only that you can subsume your life into a machine. What's wrong with this picture? But some of the very, very wealthy in the valley are buying, in fact, tickets into this themselves. And to me, that's just an utter perversion of what technology is. Nature didn't spend 14 billion years to bring stuff out of energy, life out of stuff, and consciousness out of life to, in effect, on one hand, on a religious hand, to hear messages that the world is a place of banishment, exile, and woe, which to me is blasphemy. And on the other hand, to say we need to get out of this analog world that nature spent 14 billion years creating and rather morph into a digital world that we've created. We ought to proceed that way very, very cautiously.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Light. And incidentally, I was with one of the founding board members of Singularity University last week, and we were having coffee, and it turns out that I think Ray takes 500 pills a day. I don't know if he was exaggerating, but that's the number he used. And I would not be surprised. So,
that's almost a full-time occupation.
Yeah, so you can't have a meeting with him without, like, actually seeing Ray pop in a bunch of pills, because he's, like, constantly, you know, putting that into his system. Which, you know, we'll just leave it at that. I want to just go to the next question. Also remind folks that we probably have maybe room for one or two more questions. So if you want to get in on the queue, you can hit *6, and we will move on to the next question right now.
Tom, thanks for the Rajesh here. So thank you very much for all the wonderful insights. My question is kind of related to the couple of preceding ones, which is, you mentioned in the write-up for the talk today, it was a very interesting statistic that sort of caught my eye, which is 95% of all technologists who ever worked are living today, and 95% of all philosophers or seers are dead or lived 1,500 years ago. So my question to you is, given the statistic, do you introduce a bias in your daily living, knowing that, does philosophy have greater value than technology or something analogous to that? And if so, how do you kind of integrate that into your life? I hope that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of easier for me now because I work at home and I only have to put up with myself, and that's not easy, but I'm not, as I lived for many years in the corporate world, where you got to put up with a lot of people who maybe have different agendas than you do. So I don't, in my daily life now, don't face some of the issues that I did when I was working on site at companies. It's not that 95% of the philosophers are dead. It's just that if you read any modern philosophy, it's so opaque that for lay people, we can't really get into it. It's like professionals talking to professionals. And the people who are gone, the authors of the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Upanishads, the Vedas, and so on, there's nothing wrong with what they said. But they were writing for a world that we can no longer imagine, and we're trying to take those writings into a world that those authors could never imagine. And you can see that in the religion, in the people who are of the religion of the book, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. I mean, all three of those religions are in a really tough place now by adherents who are the most vocal ones, who are doing the most outrageous things. And you know, it's like we're not, what we have to do is go back to those good old books and find what's eternal and what we need to cling to. As in the Old Testament, this is what I want, God. Justice, mercy, and humility. And you can cull those things out and not go down to the things like hitting your kid's head with a rock if they're not doing their studies. You know, how do we look at these old books and take out the best of it, what belongs and leave aside so much other stuff? Or better, another way is take the best of those old messages and rephrase them for today. You know, the Beatles song, the last song they ever recorded, ends up by saying, the love you take is equal to the love you make. I mean, that's right out of the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Hindu text, the Buddhist text, but they made it fashionable today. And like Jewel said in her song, in the end, only kindness matters. So I would encourage artists and performers especially to restate these great truths in modern language, and even somehow to begin increasing, putting them into technical papers that appear in peer review articles and so on. It's up to us to act as saboteurs, in a sense, in our own society, and to bring these age-old wisdoms alive in today's terminology, and at the same time to cull out some of the really strange stuff in all those old texts that are no longer appropriate to the world we live in. In the West, our religious tradition says, in all three of the God faiths, we hear God say, I alone will be your God, and you alone will be my chosen people. We got to move beyond that, because this idea of being chosen is running us into the ground today.
Thank
chosen
you.
As opposed to the other.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Tom, you're referencing the Beatles and the Jewel Jewel, the song lyrics, and it made me think about how you've always tried to stay connected to sort of the mainstream culture and try to liaison these ancient truths with the mainstream. And so I was wondering if you had, if you were speaking to a bunch of teenagers, what would you tell them? Just in concluding our call, I just want to, frame the conversation and an inquiry around, like, what would be the message for the younger generation that you would give, and how you'd frame it?
I was invited to speak all day at all the religion classes at a high school nearby, and I'll get to answer that, but I found it interesting that the AP class came in, and these guys were obviously tomorrow's leaders. They all had straight teeth, combed hair. You know, they were bright, alert, just everything that you'd want. And one of them raised his hand at the beginning and said, are we going to be tested on your material, Mr. Mann? And I said, not by me or not. And with that, all 30 of them folded their books, their notebooks, and put them under the desk. And their eyes went into sort of hyperglaze, because I was going to be talking about something that didn't fit into their what they thought they needed to know. Later in the afternoon, I had the D students, and they came in, and the teacher said to me, look, if you can just keep them quiet for 50 minutes, that's all we need to do. They were the most engaged people I've ever talked to. They challenged me on everything. They were alert. They were stimulating. They were great. And boy, was that a lesson to me, because when I was in school, I was in probably the AP class, and we filtered out, if we haven't learned that it's worthwhile and we can use it in our careers, never mind it. Whereas the guys who were, you might say, dead enders, they're the ones who were curious, thoughtful, and constantly were questioning. Those are the ones that I'd like to reach. And so what would I say to high schoolers? I guess it's, you're being taught a lot, and that's good. But as much as you're being taught by the past. I had a teacher in sixth grade who was the best teacher I had. She opened the class by opening up an imaginary book of knowledge, and she flipped to the imaginary first pages and said, this is filled with information, and you're going to have to learn it in my class and going forward. But now, she said, flip to the back pages of this imaginary book of knowledge. The pages are blank, and you need to start thinking now at 12 or 14 what you're going to put in those pages when your time comes, and you need to give that a lot of thought. Because the people who come after you that you can't even imagine yet are going to look to you for guidance. And I guess that was probably the best thing I ever learned in school. What are we going to put in the blank pages at the back of the book?
Wow.
And start thinking about that now.
That's beautiful, and I think relevant for all of us. You've given us so much, Tom, just in the span of these 90 minutes, 60 minutes. And it's been awesome, and I thank you all. And I don't know if everyone on the call knows, but this is particularly meaningful and gracious of Tom, because today is his 68th birthday. And I think we just randomly asked around this Saturday, but it's beautiful how these serendipities work. So, Tom, particularly thanks for sharing a little bit of your birthday with us.
Well, believe me, it was my pleasure. And again, my kudos to you and to everybody at Service Base for what you're all doing. It's what I talk about in theory, you're putting into practice. So Godspeed and keep at it.
Absolutely. We feel your blessings behind us. We want to end with just a few moments of silence and gratitude. However you want to channel your gratitude out into the world, but the idea is to really not limit it to just our circle, but may it radiate outwards. And then after that, we'll unmute everybody, and maybe we'll sing Happy Birthday to Tom. So let's do that. So let's do a minute of gratitude, and I'll... Thank you. And I think I speak on behalf of a lot of people when I say, Tom, I'm glad you came back after those 6 weeks.
Can I add a postscript?
Absolutely.
If I had to compress all of this into a bumper sticker?
Yes.
It would be to say that, to make a prayer, with our minds and our hearts, let us pray for peace. And then with our tools and our technologies, let us work for justice.
Beautiful, beautiful. We're going to unmute everybody. It's just going to be slightly chaotic. So on the count of three, I think everyone's on. It would be awesome. Don't be shy. And it would be awesome if we all just sing from our hearts and our lungs. Happy birthday to Tom. So on the count of three, off we go. One, two, three. Happy birthday,
happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday,
dear Tom.
Happy birthday
to you.
Thank you all. Yes, wonderfully chaotic birthday morning for you, Tom.
God bless you all, too. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, guys. Bye. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye,
all.